Welcome to the 29th Annual Executive War College brought to you by The Dark Report. This year's conference was in beautiful New Orleans, April 30th through May 1st. The title of this presentation is Panel, Current State and Future Directions for Digital Pathology, from Histology and Scanning to Pathologist Workflow and AI-Powered Analysis of Whole Slide Images. The presenters are Esther Abels, CEO, Solaris RTC LLC, Boston, Massachusetts, Lisa Jean Clifford, COO and Chief Strategy Officer, Gestalt Diagnostics, Spokane, Washington, Leo Grady, PhD, CEO, Jonah, Darien, Connecticut, and Vaishali Panu, PhD, Vice President, Digital Pathology, Caris Life Sciences, Phoenix, Arizona.
Well, welcome everybody. Good to see you all, and I'm very pleased to be here. I was also very honored to be invited to be the moderator of this session with this great panel. And I know you do not need necessarily an introduction, but I will do that anyway. So we have our panelists, Lisa Jean Clifford. She's the CEO and the Chief Strategic Officer of Gestalt Diagnostics. And she has been involved for more than two decades already in a high-tech healthcare solution space. Her passion is making a positive impact on the lives of patients through technology and can be traced back to her career as she served in vital business development, products and marketing roles, and to Psyche Systems, an LIS solution provider where she was the CEO for 11 years. Now, as a recognized industry expert, she actively participates in numerous boards, including the Association of Pathology Informatics and MLO's Editorial Advisory Board. She focusing on delivering valuable content in critical areas such as lab automation, including software, and interoperability, digital pathology, AI in pathology, lab informatics, oncology, and women's health. Welcome.
Thank you.
And we have Vaishali Panu. She's the Vice President of Digital Pathology at Caris Life Sciences. She is a cell and molecular scientist by training, and she has well-published contributions in the cancer biomarker discovery and validation space. She has been working at the intersection of clinic and research for 8 years now, focusing on clinical implementation of image-based solutions with a focus on efficiency and data quality. Vaishali oversees digital pathology operations at a case volume of more than 500 cases a day and generating more than 1 million whole slide imaging images per year, which is phenomenal. Caris's digital pathology operations under her leadership has gone 100% digital, with 85% of case sign-out being done using slide scans. And I want to mention that we know in the U.S. there's only about 10% of the labs are digital. So kudos to you that you got this accomplished. Your long-term interest in clinical applications of spatial biomarkers fuels her efforts towards digital transformation of pathology and lab medicine. She believes in empowering clinical labs with the right tools to prepare for transformative biomarker assays and technologies on the horizon. Welcome.
Thank you.
And then we have Leo Grady, the founder and CEO of Yona. Leo is internationally recognized for his work to deliver AI in healthcare for 20 years at pioneering Bay Area startups like HeartFlow, multinational medical companies like Siemens, and most recently as CEO, as we all know, of Paige AI. As the CEO of Paige, Leo led the company to become an industry leader, internationally launching groundbreaking products and receiving the first ever FDA approval for an AI product in pathology. And that was already like, what was it now, about 3-4 years ago, right?
Yeah, 2021.
So we're waiting for the next one to come. So we're all going to learn today how to do that. Leo also authored two books on AI, over 100 peer-reviewed scientific papers, and is an inventor on over 300 patents, winner of the Edison Patent Award. He was inducted as fellow in the American Institute for Medical and Biological Engineering, and he earned a PhD in cognitive and neural systems from BU. He is the CEO in residence with Briar Capital and the founder of CEO of Yona. So today what we're going to discuss with this panel is we noticed that AI and machine learning in healthcare is picking up. It's really getting there, and especially also digital pathology is finally getting there. And I think digital pathology has this great challenge with, at the same time that digital pathology is finally getting adopted and that people are starting implementing it, at the same time we're also getting AI on the market. So we're doing things at the same time, and we do that in parallel, while, for example, radiology went digital and now are using more and more of AI. So I think we've got a great challenge there. So we're all going to look at it, what role will AI and ML play, and what should the benchmark be to support healthcare to pivot to value-based models, actually. And with this session, we would like to share our thoughts of the panel and what we can expect from, we've seen what it is, so we're reflecting a little bit on that, what was the present, but also what can we expect in the future and how can we pivot it. So actually, yesterday we've seen the presentations, we know that the LDT rule is kicking in, so there will be a lot of changes ahead of us. But also thinking about, based on your own experience in the institute and industry, what do you believe are the main drivers right now for adoption in digital pathology? We can think out of the box in all kind of directions. I'd like to start with you, Lisa, Jean.
So I think there's a variety of drivers, and it really depends on the organization. Each organization will have their own goals and objectives for adopting digital and for incorporating AI. The main drivers, as I think we've heard through several of the presentations yesterday and today, are really around improving patient care, improving outcomes, streamlining efficiencies, providing accurate information in a timely way, but then also being able to cut expenses where you're looking at things like distributed environments, shipping of glass, storage of glass, and then, of course, the FTEs required to support that.
Yeah, thanks. And when you say with the glass and everything, do you think that we could get rid of that? And I might be jumping ahead a little bit, but I'm curious what your thoughts are.
I do think there will be a time, and certainly with the digitization of the images, the quality of the image will last forever, whereas we all know that glass and specimens degrade over time. Mm-hmm. So I do think there will absolutely be a time where the glass will no longer be required, and it will be the digital image that will be the source of truth.
Yeah, thanks. I'm curious to learn how you have implemented all that, Vishala, what you can share about what your thoughts about this.
Sure. At Caris, we all know a lot of drivers are institution specific, but I mean specifically at Caris, it all started with decentralization of pathologist workforce, and for us, that still remains to be one of the big drivers for adoption to digital pathology. Another one being able to, you know, combine image data with molecular data could be a gold mine for, enhanced predictive and diagnostic biomarkers. That's also another big driver for Caris. In general, in the field, scanning technology has improved significantly in the recent years. You know, faster scan times, better image quality, better tissue finding algorithms, onboard QC. All of that adds value to, you know, adopting a digital pathology operations or workflow. Enhanced industry-wide integration of IMS platforms with scanning platforms. And that enhances future-proofing because it basically drives a vendor-agnostic approach, and then, you know, it speaks a lot to long-term success of initiatives like digital pathology that take a lot of upfront investment.
Yeah. And when you say that upfront investment, was that mostly focused on changing the entire workflow, or what was the biggest?
Right. So, I mean, the biggest, you know, day one investment as you start to think about digitizing slides is, you know, zeroing in on the scanning technology. Buying scanners or leasing scanners is a huge investment. Investment in resourcing when it comes to you know, controlling quality of images, because that's really the at the heart of, you know, the quality of interpretation, be it visual or AI-based. And so I think it's both resources and hardware up front, in addition to completely, well, more or less completely overhauling, you know, your IT infrastructure, because you have to establish pretty robust, you know, image pipelines that may or may not conflict with your already existing molecular, you know, assay pipelines.
Thanks for sharing. What about you, Leo? You've been like in the AI and the hard flow, and then also with Paige and digital pathology. What's your take here?
Well, I mean, historically, the drivers of digitization pathology have really been education, sharing, retrieval. I think when COVID happened, a lot of pathologists were asking themselves, you know, why can everybody else work from home, and yet I need to go into the lab and touch slides that have been gone through, you know, 10 different people and ship slides around. And, you know, they wanted to be able to work from home and have those sorts of opportunities as well. So I think that was a big driver toward being able to, or toward driving adoption of digital pathology. At the end of the day, though, I mean, it's the costs, the disruptions are significant, and the value really has to be there. And I think the value ultimately is going to be from AI applications. And I think it'll go really beyond what we think of as, you know, pathology assistance. I mean, that's happening. I mean, that exists. As you mentioned, we built this FDA-approved AI system at Paige for prostate cancer. But I think there are a lot more opportunities for how AI can enhance the workflow. I mean, everything from, you know, sorting the cases, putting the case to the right pathologist, ordering them in a way so that if you need an additional stain, that one happens first so that gets ordered earlier, being able to retrieve similar cases from your archives and your database to be able to compare those. But then even going beyond that, looking at, you know, can the AI look at the structure of a tumor and identify a molecular marker so that you don't necessarily need to go and sequence this tissue. There's so many different possibilities and opportunities with all of these AI technologies that are being built, and I think people are not necessarily recognizing what's already there and the power that can come with it, but also what the possibilities are going to be in the future.
Yeah, definitely. And we just had sessions also, and it has been said before, optimizing the workflow, gaining efficiency. There's a lot of course, investment needed, but the return on investment is there. I hear that. But I also do recognize that we don't have the reimbursement yet. So often we hear the reimbursement that is really needed. We need to incentivize the users. And I think I would like to even go beyond the users. I also always think about who applies it to the patient. So it's not only the pathologist, but also who applies it. But looking at that, so do you believe that getting right CPT codes, that will support adoption? And if so, what type of criteria should payers to consider to reimburse it for AI and ML to be implemented? Hashelli, would you like to go first?
Sure.
Yeah.
Yes, we all know there is, you know, Category 3 CPT codes that currently exist as add-on, and I mean they're really add-ons. And Esther, as you mentioned in your talk also in the past hour, they do not consider a lot of investment and just infrastructural as well as resource investment that goes into going digital. So of course, you know, conversion from a Category 3 to a Category 1 would be great, but it's also very challenging. It's not an easy feat. What else can we consider, you know, in absence of, you know, proper reimbursement as alternative financial incentives? One use case would be for medium to large labs. You know, again, going back to what I was saying, molecular data currently combined with image data it offers significant, you know, opportunities for novel signature development, something biopharma is currently really investing in. And that's one avenue that does not, you know, compensate for no reimbursement, but also could offer an additional alternative as a financial invest, you know, an incentive. In terms of, you know, how do we regulate and what should be considered for an AI and ML solution? I think we all can agree the potential benefits of AI solutions, from interpretation to novel biomarker. It does enhance patient outcomes. It does, you know, enhance provider, productivity. And so for, with that in mind, there should be a value-based incentive model rather than volume-based. And this, I think, would be great when determining value for AIs and for reimbursement of it.
Yeah, I appreciate that because I also believe, indeed, that it's more and more towards value-based instead of really focusing on the volume. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, still with there, we don't have CPT coach yet. Is there anything else that we could... Yeah, Lisa Jean, is there anything else that we could do maybe to increase that, or are there any other drivers that you could think of?
So obviously there's cost savings, and one of the things that I have heard from people who are looking to adopt digital from the workflow perspective is that initially pathologists are concerned that it's going to slow their workflow, that they're not going to be as fast. But the studies show, and our experience has been, that after 2 to 4 months of using digital, they're much faster on digital than they ever were on glass. And if you go back and think about when pathologists are initially using glass, they're not as quick on glass either. So there's a slight learning curve to be able to get up to that speed, and then you've got the efficiency gains there. In terms of CPT codes and reimbursement, I think that smaller and maybe smaller to mid-size labs are probably more concerned with that, and I think that will drive broader adoption. But the things that we're seeing in terms of mid to large size labs, large academic centers, research facilities, the reimbursement really isn't the reason for going digital. And so, again, different organizations will have different reasons to go digital. As Vaishali said, some are looking to be able to monetize some of the value within the images, and within the patient case information. And so there's definitely that route and that avenue, but then there's also, again, the improved patient care, there's the accuracy, there's altruistic reasons, there's training, there's pathologist, you know, credentialing management, there's onboarding, there's a variety of reasons, and many organizations have funds in other areas that they can apply to their adoption if they're creative with where those funds come from.
Great, thanks, yeah. Yeah, hearing this, I also, we're all waiting for the CPT codes, and I think that should come along. It will help. But I'm also like, why are we waiting? When we hear this, there's so many benefits. A lab going fully digital has all these efficiency gains. So why are we not doing it? And also, yeah, Leo, I'm really looking forward to hear your experience as well with, I know you have experience with HeartFlow, how that went. So maybe you could share a little bit about your perspective there.
Yeah, I mean, if any of you saw my talk earlier, I talked about different business models and ways you can integrate AI into healthcare. And I think within pathology, there are really three possibilities. You know, one is that you just drive more efficiencies, and based on the value from those efficiencies, you can do more cases, you can cut costs, and that really justifies the value of adopting these technologies. There's the other possibility where some company builds an AI technology and then gives it away to you for free, but then takes your data and monetizes it with pharma or something like that. And then the third possibility, which is the one that you were getting at, Esther, is, you know, you really go the med device route and you say, okay, this is a medical device. It's going to improve patient care. It costs this much. It adds this much value into the system. And then you do the clinical utility trials, you get, you know, a CPT code, you get CMS reimbursement, private payer reimbursement, and really go that route. I think on that last piece, one of the challenges with doing that is that it's very expensive and a long road to actually do all of those trials and fight your way through CMS and NICE recommendations and all these different things. And then at the end of the day, if you're going to invest all of that, the reimbursement better really be significant enough to, you know, pay for all of that investment that you put into the clinical evidence generation. And I think if it's, you know, at the end of the day, if you're going to save a pathologist, you know, 5 minutes to, or, you know, 5 seconds to do a prostate biopsy or a breast biopsy, I don't know that it's going to be worth it, from the standpoint of, you know, the clinical grade element that's necessary to build that kind of technology. Where you might be able to develop that sort of reimbursement level would be if you could replace molecular testing. If you could say, like, by looking at this tumor, now you can significantly reduce the number of cases that need to go to Foundation Medicine or Tempus or Castle Bio. So I'm going to get myself in trouble here. But, I mean, if you could, like, really, you know, reduce those cases that need to go out for really expensive testing by adopting an AI pathology read in up front, then those are the kinds of things where you might be able to generate sufficient reimbursement.
Yeah. And do we then believe, if we want to get this reimbursement, do we believe that we as a community should be approaching that? Because there's also, of course, the PLA codes that we have. So what are your thoughts there? I'll start with you now.
Well, I mean, obviously for labs are going to want to make money from adopting this sort of technology, right? So whether it's through, you know, PLA codes or CMS or, you know, however they're getting paid for adopting this technology, you know, if there's some sort of margin that they can generate, then it's going to be advantageous for them to do it. You know, if at the end of the day the value accrues to someone else downstream in the hospital system, I think it's going to be much harder for them to adopt and pay for and invest in all the infrastructure that's necessary to adopt these technologies.
Yeah, got it. And I'm curious, does the rest of the panel, do you have also some ideas with, like, who should be on those reimbursement panels, right? Because who is going to judge whether it is, what is the value? Because ultimately what we're seeing right now with the value, with the volume-based care, is that the patient is actually paying the price because we're now waiting with implementing digital pathology. So what do you think, are there any recommendations with regards to how can we maybe speed this up, or also who should be on those panels of the reimbursements?
So I'll take that one. I think that it's extremely important to have a broad spectrum of perspectives and representation on those panels. I think that vendors should absolutely be represented because, as Leo pointed out, there's a huge investment that vendors are making in developing and testing and validating these algorithms, as well as the digital workflows and platforms, to be able to justify those reimbursements. But then there's also representation by the pathologists, medical directors, the actual facilities who are employing these technologies to be able to also support the costs that they have from the infrastructure, the workflow changes, the staff, the complete retooling of their laboratories, depending on what workflows and which technologies that they are deploying should be represented. But then I also think that the patients and the payers should be included on these panels. So and should provide their representation and their perspective, because from a payer's perspective, when you're applying AI and you're getting more succinct, faster turnaround times, faster and more accurate diagnoses, you're in turn lowering the overall cost of care of that patient. So there's a value there. And then again, patients. So, you know, for people in our industry, I would certainly want AI applied to my biopsies or my children's or anyone else's that I care about. And I think that as patients are becoming more educated and more aware of the technology that's available in healthcare, they should have a voice as well.
Yeah, thanks.
I'd also just like to add that, you know, it'd be a good idea to have champions of digital pathology, particularly labs who have adopted, you know, digital pathology would be a good addition, because that provides a realistic, you know, use case and realistic challenges that the labs have to overcome, and provide just, you know, an in-depth analysis of how much does it take or cost to go digital, and what should be proper reimbursement, you know, models to get.
If I could just say another word on this, I we talk a lot about looking at radiology, because radiology is 20 years ahead or whatever in terms of applying those lessons to pathology. And I was in radiology for a decade, working at Siemens, and then at HeartFlow we were working with radiology and cardiac CT. And I can tell you very clearly that most of the AI companies in radiology are struggling, and most of the radiology reads that are being done today are not super highly AI powered. And the companies that are doing well, and the ways that AI is being adopted in radiology, are somewhat surprising, right? So I mean, you see like bundled products like Siemens and Philips and GE that are putting the AI into the scanners. You see some AI applications that are being integrated into the reconstructions, you know, like a Subtle Medical or something like that. You see obviously like AI on the reporting, like, you know, with Nuance and so on. But at HeartFlow and Cleerly and other companies that have gotten serious reimbursement, you know, at HeartFlow we were getting reimbursed at $1,450 per use of our AI technology for analyzing a cardiac CT. Mind you, the reimbursement for the CT itself and the radiology read was about $450, right? So just think about that. The AI technology was three times the entire acquisition and read of the CT. But what's important to know here is that HeartFlow was selling to the cardiologists. Cleerly is selling to the cardiologists. The companies that are actually making money in this space, where they are delivering AI into radiology, are not selling to radiology. And so radiology has had a very, I'm not sure, I don't want to say anything down about that crowd, because I have a lot of friends in radiology. But I think the view within radiology is like, well, you know, once an AI is good enough to replace me, then we'll adopt it. But I think that's it's really kind of a negative attitude. And as a result, like, where AI is getting used to actually circumvent the radiologist and sell into the radiologist's customers, to cardiology and in the case of HeartFlow and Cleerly.
Yeah, that's very interesting, because it's also coming back then again to patients who might, well, either they pay the price for not getting the latest and greatest technology and the best assessments, and then also with that, if they do get the assessment and pay the price for it, the costs really, then they pay those costs. So it's interesting to see that, and it might happen also in digital pathology, which scares me a little bit, because then we can get, again, coming back to like who can pay it and who cannot pay it. So I do believe that there's a serious investment is needed. And if you look in Europe, in the UK, for example, the government is investing heavily in using digital pathology, creating interoperability, supporting it, making sure that there are networks of using digital pathology. So thinking about like, and also looking at time, because I want to give the audience some time to ask questions as well. Also looking at it from the perspective, coming back to the workflows and investment, is there anything that we believe that the technology has value, right? So is there anything that workflow can influence this, or how can we turn it around that it will be implemented, that we get some investment and start using it? Shelly, I would like to start with you.
So for us really at Caris, when we started to embrace digital first workflow, which means, you know, instead of you know, where a pathologist is offsite or onsite, that driving how much we need to digitize. We started to prioritize digitizing slides, striving to that 100% digitization. That really changed everything for us, and we started to see, you know, significant efficiencies throughout the lab. I mean, it took us a much larger team to, you know, begin with when we started going digital, but 4 years into it, we're starting to see the trend downwards where we're able to significantly scale up without adding FTEs in the lab specifically. There are key areas where we started to see, you know, significant efficiencies, specifically in the histotech area, where now that we're digitizing, we're able to automate a lot of the work that, you know, from the QC standpoint, you know, image QC is one thing, but also there's significant resourcing that goes into stain QC at about 4,000 slides every day in our lab. That's a huge resource. So we're now implementing automated, you know, AI or image analysis-based algorithms to detect positive and negative controls on slides, any tissue washouts. All of that could be automated now that, you know, it's a digital asset, and that's bringing significant efficiencies. We're now not spending, you know, that much manpower on slide retrieval for multiple reasons, for, you know, research, supporting research. And sometimes, you know, you have the same patient, you know, additional sample from the same patient, and pathologists need to look at, you know, those older slides. Now that we're digitizing for good enough time, we're not having to constantly retrieve, you know, slides for all those multiple reasons. And that's manpower saving within the lab. Just enhanced case tracking is saving us, man, you know, FTEs hours daily, because now this is a digital asset. We could use or implement rule-based case distribution, you know, models, and that is, again, a workflow efficiency. So in general, I would just like to say that as lab leaders, when we're looking at incentives for digital adoption, we should weigh in expenditures of not going digital compared to when a lab, you know, is going digital or would go digital. For Caris, we really looked at what's the cost of attracting pathologists from all the different states, from California to Phoenix, which is a tough sell, we all recognize. And so, you know, what is the cost of doing that? What is the cost of, you know, constantly tracking physical slides throughout the lab, you know, for so many different reasons? As we all know, slides tend to, you know, get lost within the workflow. What is the cost of scale up? You know, as we had to in the last 2 to 3 years, we saw our case volume increase from 30% year on year. And, you know, if we had not gone digital, what would be the cost of that? So I think that puts things into perspective for us.
Yeah, that's great information. Thanks. Yeah. Anything to add from you, Lisa Jean? Yeah.
Well, I'd like to say what she said. but I think, you know, again, each organization is going to have their own challenges, their own goals, their own objectives, and certainly the ideal is what Caris has implemented in their approach, and I completely applaud Vaishali and her team. However, that's not everyone's use case, and some organizations are looking for how they can just simply get started. How can we start down this path, putting one foot in front of another, and hopefully getting to the point where they're 100% digital and they're realizing all of these gains? And in those instances, I would say there's, again, a lot of low-hanging fruit, and working with individuals within your organization and external, and honestly, from a vendor perspective, I think we're all acting as coaches as well, to help aid you in this journey, is understanding and identifying where that low-hanging fruit is for your organization and using those as the first initial gains for justification and for success.
Thanks. Yeah, absolutely. Anything to add from your side, Leo?
Nope. No, I think we can leave it there.
All right. Then I would like to open up the floor for questions. Any questions from the audience? I'll run around with a microphone. Well, running is a big word. walking.
One of you had brought up the idea of monetization of the image. You know, there's a lot of data mining that can occur from these images, even from an H&E. And I'm wondering if there's been any even early studies on if some of the data that we're getting from IHC, Fish, Molecular, can be simulated by the data that we're getting from the H&E and any associated cost savings that come with that. Maybe too early, but I was just wondering if there's anything even in the works.
Yeah, I can take that one. So there's actually been a fair bit of work on that. I guess, gosh, maybe 5, 6, 7 years ago, the TCGA was put together that had, this was a public data set that had H&E as well as molecular imaging or, you know, molecular analysis of different tumors. A whole variety of different groups, including us at Page, were looking at the opportunity for using H&E to predict IHC, to predict, you know, sequencing and somatic changes in the tumors. And I would say that there is a, you know, certainly quite a bit of evidence that that can be done. I mean, I remember talking to a lot of pathologists who say, you know, I can see an FGFR mutation in a tumor. People will say, I can see whether it's HER2 positive just by looking at the tissue. And so, you know, if that's really true, then it ought to be possible to build AI that can do this much more systematically and with, you know, a real sensitivity and specificity. I would say to date, I am not aware of anyone who's done the cost analysis or the health economics for it. But from a technology standpoint, there's pretty solid evidence that at least for some immunohistochemistry or molecular markers, it is possible to detect them from the H&E with pretty strong reliability.
Yeah, and I also think with regards to the tumor microenvironment that you can start using then and implementing it. And, yeah, I hear your question. I also think, like, next genome sequencing then will become much easier, right? Like, this patient could have benefits and that one could have not. So I think there will be lots of benefits with regards to health economics. Yeah, thanks.
Is there any approved way to validate the scanning, like a digital pathology, by scan and then do the pathology by digitally? Is there any approved way to validate that?
So if I understand your question correctly, you're asking if there's a documented or regulatory approved way to do it, and the answer is that today it is following the CAP guidelines for LDT. But certainly there's also the FDA certification. So depending on what your organization's workflows are and what you're looking to implement for technology and the way the regulatory bodies move, the way that most facilities are using it today is through the LDT method, and that is so that they can be innovative and they can move quickly and they can take advantage of the latest technologies.
There are ways, though, to validate that the a digital diagnosis is the same as a class diagnosis, if that's what you're asking. I mean, Esther actually pioneered the first FDA approval for doing this at Philips. And I think we were maybe the second or the third to do so. Leica did it afterward. And since then, there have been a few other viewers that have been validated and FDA approved for equivalency of a digital diagnosis against a class diagnosis. So Philips was the first, and then everything else was a 510K off that.
Yeah, and I think there are great challenges there with regards to the interoperability, because it's indeed, again, like, what is your use case? How did you set it up? What's the interoperability? And that really drives also what the governments are looking for. So it's not only in the U.S. the FDA is looking for something, but also in Europe, also looking at it like from different perspectives and how you need to validate. So at this moment, there's no standardized way to do it, but that's something that we need to work on. I believe that we as a community need to work on that, especially now with the LDT.
So one of the predictor of patient survival and tumor response is tumor heterogeneity. So I don't think morphologically we are able to accurately predict that, even by molecular as well. So I'll be very skeptical of, you know, just by morphology or digital images, you know, you are able to predict who's going to respond and who's not going to respond, what will be the prognostic factors, all those things. So definitely, I think for the near future, we still require a molecular evidence. Even I practice both hempath and molecular, still, I can say this is APL, acute promyelocytic leukemia, still needs some of the cases, still need a confirmation of most of the cases by cytogenetics, facial molecular methods. So in solid tumors, it's way heterogeneous than heme malignancies. So I don't think, you know, just by morphologically, even though it's high concordance, but still in most of the cases, we require the clear-cut evidence in order to start a therapy.
Yeah, I mean, I do think that it's, you know, case-to-case basis and multimodal approach in that case could help. Heterogeneity has always been, both in the molecular assays as well as, you know, image-based, has always been difficult to analyze and, you know, sort of, you know, it's difficult to factor that in a lot of assays, and completely agree with that, you know, in cases where heterogeneity is an issue, image-based, you know, just prediction might not be enough. And it also goes back to the sampling, right? Like, just maybe one tumor slice, is that enough also to determine just, in, you know, intratumoral heterogeneity? So it definitely goes back to just the foundational assays that we're currently even running in the lab.
Yeah, I don't think you could make a blanket statement one way or the other. Certainly, I wouldn't advocate to get rid of molecular. But heterogeneity can be overcome with sufficient data, where, you know, you expose an AI system to a whole range of different slicing, staining, scanning techniques, different, you know, optical variations and color balancing. There's a lot of different ways in which you can go after that question with enough data, but there remains a fundamental question, which is the signal there or not, right? I mean, can you actually look at morphology and predict function and you know, molecular drug response? And I would say that, you know, there's evidence that in some cases you can do it somewhat well. Whether, you know, adding enough data means you could do it in a way that would replace a molecular test in some cases, it's possible. I think it's an open question. Whether you're going to be able to just look at morphology, even with enough data, and replace all molecular testing, I certainly don't think so.
Biology of cancers, genetic or molecular events, and morphology. As in morphologically looks, a lot of MDS early stages, they all look normal, but you know they still have cytogenetics or molecular events, which happens way earlier than morphologically.
Well, I mean,
years, like if you look at a lot of other malignant mycosis fungi, it takes quite 10 years to diagnose mycosis fungi. To diagnose MDS, they take very long time than what morphology.
I mean, there have been AI systems that have been available for about, you know, 6, 7, 8 years, where you can take a picture of a baby's face and you can tell if they have Down syndrome with almost perfect accuracy. Now, Down syndrome is defined by a genetic variation in the germline, and it's, you know, to fully confirm a diagnosis of Downs, you would need to go do the molecular test and measure the kid's genome, but it's quite possible to, you know, look at the morphology of that child's face and identify the underlying genetics with high accuracy. And it's not that the biology doesn't matter, it's just that the biology is phenotypically expressed through the morphology of the child's face. And I think it's a very similar analogy in tumor and other aspects of biology. Like, yes, there's an underlying molecular driver, but if it's phenotypically expressed in a way that is consistent and detectable, then you may be able to work backward to identify what that driver is.
And I think to your point as well with like doing then a confirmative test thereafter, right? That's something that really helps with the turnaround time, getting earlier patient management that they're supposed to get, and then maybe do some kind of confirmative test later on. So I think there's added value, not necessarily displacing, but there's certainly added value there. I saw there was a... Hang on 1 second, please.
So to piggyback on that thought, we're used to looking at surrogate markers in the lab. And you just have to understand that a surrogate marker is not a test for the disease. It's a test for an indicator of the disease. So when a man tests positive for what we call a pregnancy test, we don't think he's pregnant, right? Well, that's a surrogate marker. It's beta-HCG. It is high in pregnant women. It grows higher as the pregnancy progresses. And so that's what we use as a surrogate marker for pregnancy. But that doesn't necessarily mean that a woman is pregnant. She could also have a tumor, just like when a man tests positive for that. So there's all these different surrogate markers that may or may, you know, PSA for prostate cancer. Everybody with a high PSA does not have prostate cancer. So what we're talking about in AI, in image analysis, is a surrogate marker. Does the phenotype suggest a certain genotype, which may or may not, you know, be accurate. Our PD-L1s don't agree. There's all kinds of disagreement that we deal with in pathology, and AI is just one additional solution that's not perfect but can advance our science. To me, the bigger question is not can it detect heterogeneity or can it detect this. It's like, well, if it can detect a certain genotype, and that indicates, predicts response to a certain drug. Well, if that, the FDA has already declared if you don't have that CDX, the patient's not going to be covered for the drug. So I put in a question about, are the pharma companies using AI for their clinical trials as a CDX? Because if they're not, then we can't use AI to tell which patients. So they updated, WHO updated the glioblastoma or CNS tumors a couple years ago, and methylation now can predict with supreme accuracy, according to these studies, whether or not the tumor will be IDH1 or 2 or some of these other, you know, genetic markers. But it doesn't matter if that's not what you have to do the drug, then we're doing the IDH1 and 2 tests. So but all this to say, if we don't use AI and we don't put it to the test and we don't try to use it and advance the science of it, then we'll never get there. And with the shortage of pathologists, I don't see how we have a choice. I really don't.
Yeah, I 100% agree. I think it's well said. I mean, you mentioned PSA, right? PSA is not a diagnosis of prostate cancer, but if it's high, then you go get a diagnosis of prostate cancer. And so it is a cheap surrogate marker. That's not bad for sensitivity.
Thanks. We've got time for one last question.
When you're implementing digital pathology, are there differences in the implementation of digital path for biopsies like GI, skin, GYN biopsies compared to, say, resections of prostates or radical hysterectomies? And how do you overcome those, and can you use it for all sorts of biopsies, or is it more amenable just to the smaller biopsies?
So in terms of implementing digital pathology, there's no difference in terms of the technology itself, how it's implemented, how it's deployed. The differences are in the workflows. So when you're configuring and actually implementing the system, those workflows are being taken into consideration and they're built into your implementation process.
I just add on that, you know, I was speaking about scanning technologies and how they have evolved over time, and I would say that there is a difference in success rate of, you know, a scanner scanning a core biopsy versus a resection. There is a lot of pre-analytics that go into it to, the extent of folding in a tissue that happens quite a lot in like bigger tissues like resections, how does that lend itself to a successful, you know, image that can be used for interpretation? So there's definitely a lot of considerations in the scanning technology as such, and some scanners are better at picking, you know, smaller tissue or, you know, cytology specimens, and some scanners are much better in detecting larger tissues and, you know, just minimizing the impacts of folds and such by volumetric analysis. So there's, I mean, a thorough assessment of, you know, the sample pool that your lab has would lead to proper solutions when it comes to scanning and then success of digitization in that sense.
In terms of converting your pathologists, you're not seeing any difference in those people that look at biopsies versus resections? They're both, the learning curve is similar?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. So when we started out when we started digitizing, there were obviously more challenges in digitizing core biopsies for us. And what was happening is off-site pathologists were getting much easier cases, mostly resections, easy to interpret, whereas on-site pathologists were getting all these really, you know, just hard to interpret, but also just bad quality slides because obviously we're not digitizing them. So that was causing that initial disparity among, you know, if you're an off-site or an on-site pathologist. So we have since, and that was the biggest reason we wanted to strive towards, you know, just scanning everything by implementing multiple different technologies to get to that 100% digitization. So there's, you know, we can circumvent those disparities, and it shouldn't matter where a pathologist is working from, and there should be fairness in work distribution.
Thank you. I think, unfortunately, we're running out of time. If there's still questions, I'm positive that the panel is happy to address answers later on after this session. But I'd like to thank you all for being here and your engaging questions and the intellect discussions. And thank you very much for the panel for responding to those. Thank you.
This concludes the presentation. Please visit the Executive War College website for details on the 2025 event.